The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada and is supported by the generous donations of our listeners. If you would like to partner with us in this ministry, please go to apologeticscanada.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
We have a bit of a heavy topic today, so why don't we start it off with something a bit more lighthearted. Terry.
Yeah.
and so we're throwing it to you, Terry.
Happy don't Independence Day, by the way, Andy.
Yeah. But, for all you Americans, July 4th, celebrating the land of the free and the home of the brave. I do need to just say something about that, by the way. For those of you Americans, now July 1st is Canada Day. Mm-hmm. And my mom actually came and visited me. She's from Portland and she's hanging with me here in Canada. And her birthday's on July 1st. Mm. So we were celebrating my mom's birthday and Canada's 150th birthday. My mom's just shy of that.
I was gonna say.
maybe a lot shy of that. She actually hit me. She's like, because I said that to her. And she's like, oh, Andy. But the thing that was funny is she said to my wife, Nancy, she goes, so how long has Canada been celebrating its freedom? And I'm like, well, Mom, they're actually not free. My American mom had no idea what to do with that. There was no compartment. We have a very interesting
relationship with
the UK in Canada that's odd.
We are a constitutional monarchy, so monarchy still. But I have to say, two countries that are very young, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
Especially as somebody coming from a country whose history reaches back like almost 5,000 years, I come to a country like Canada and I look around and I go, wow, like just how
Korea
much.
Korea goes back 5,000 years.
Well,
You just blew my mind.
Something closer to like 4,500, really. But
wow.
They just round it up.
Did they have anything equivalent to samurais in the Korean past?
They had their warriors, right?
How do you say ninja in Korean?
Ninja.
that was really unsatisfying.
Just as soon as you ask the question, I'm like, oh man,
Korean.
I'm gonna let you know.
I've been speaking Korean this whole time.
You didn't even know. Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, I look at Canada and I go, wow, only been around for 150 years as a country.
That's what really struck me that day. I was like, that is so young.
Look at just how much Canada has accomplished, though. You know, it's become an economic world power. It has a very prominent place in the world stage. And I would say much the same thing about the United States. I mean, the U.S. has been around for a little longer, but relatively speaking, still very young. Two countries that are relatively young have just grown and accomplished a lot.
All right. Back to you, Terry.
Yeah, back to me. All right. This story happened yesterday. I wanted to say happy Independence Day to you, but this was on Independence Day in New York. Joey Chestnut.
We can stop right there.
I know. I was just putting that out there, right there.
You could have said Joey, but no.
It's Joey Chestnut.
That is fantastic. Wow.
And his nickname is Jaws as well.
It just doesn't stop.
No. Joey Chestnut wins 2017 Nathan's Hot Dog Eaten Contest.
That's actually a pretty famous contest.
Yeah. So he captured his 10th mustard belt.
No mercy.
On Tuesday by eating a record 72 hot dogs in 10 minutes.
Dude, I can't handle two hot dogs, let alone 72.
Darren Rovell, he's with ESPN, took a nutritional tally of the hot dogs he ate.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay.
Let's just be clear here. Mystery meat.
True. Very true. So in 10 minutes, he consumed 20,160 calories. Fat was 1,296 grams.
Oh, that is just foul. Wow.
Cholesterol was 2,160 milligrams. Sodium, 56,160 milligrams. And protein, he got a lot of protein, 720 grams of protein in 10 minutes. So when he finished, he won by a long margin. I think the guy had like the next guy down was like 53. So it was a big Yikes. Margin.
Why
right?
would you do that? I would just be like, you know, just keeping one up on the guy.
I know, but wow. I guess the total record was 73 or 4 or something like that.
Oh, he's trying to beat the record.
He's trying to beat his own record, actually.
And it was his own record.
His own record. But he won $10,000. In 10 minutes, he won $10,000. No?
I don't think so, man.
That's $1,000 a minute.
Yeah, you got me there.
How much was the calories again?
20,160
Do you think
calories.
He purged himself afterwards?
I would think he would.
Try working
off
that one.
I would not want that in my stomach for the rest of the day.
Okay. Okay, now that we have totally grossed out all of our listeners.
Thank you for that, though, Terry. You're welcome. That was good.
Let's move on to something a bit heavier. You might have seen this story coming out of the UK recently. If you've heard the name Charlie Gard,
I was talking actually with some family about this over the weekend. And I was really surprised. Many of them hadn't heard.
Really?
Yeah, the story. And I think we're going to, you know, it's starting to make the rounds.
Okay.
But yeah, tell us about it,
Steve. Yeah, I've been seeing this one left, right, and center. Basically, what's happening is this 10-month-old, now 11-month-old, I think, baby, his name is Charlie Gard. He has a very rare genetic disease, mitochondrial depletion syndrome, that causes progressive muscle atrophy and brain damage. And so the doctors at Great Ormond Street Hospital appealed to the court, basically saying, you know, like, allow us to remove the life support because the parents aren't willing to let that happen. And so this legal battle ensued.
So first of all, I just got to say, as a parent, when you read about this, it just grabs at your heart because you understand as a parent, you would do absolutely anything. And I mean, particularly as a parent that first is told they have a healthy child, right? And then slowly it's being revealed to them that this child is not healthy. And then to the point where this child going to die is on life support, and now as a parent they're needing to wrestle with the decision, well, what do you do?
Yeah.
And then there's a possible hope, right, on the other side of the pond.
Charlie has suffered brain damage, and so basically he's going to, unless something changes, Charlie is going to live in this vegetative state with feeding tubes and, you know, breathing through a ventilator, that sort of thing. But there is this experimental treatment available in the U.S. and it has been done on a child that has not the identical disease, but a similar one, some kind of a mitochondrial disease. And this child, Art Estopinen Jr., when he was born, he was given 2 months to live. But with this treatment now, he's 6 years old and he's still wheelchair bound and everything, but his father's saying, you know, we're having a happy life. So then to wrap up the story, the parents, Chris Gard and Connie Yates, they privately raised donations.
But do you know what the amount
target
was?
The target was 1.2 million, 1.2 million pounds, but they well exceeded that. Now it's like 1.3 million pounds. And so they have the money and they want to take Charlie to the U.S. for this experimental treatment, but the doctors are asking the court to allow them to remove life support.
This is the part where my brain just can't seem to comprehend. Why on earth would the – like, help me out, Steve, mm-hmm. Terry. Why on earth would the doctors want to go to the courts to end this child's life when this child could be taken to another hospital – and dealt with by other physicians and could try this experimental treatment? You know, why would they want to stop that?
Right. Just so we're clear, as we're talking about this, it's easy to – I'm not saying you're doing this, Andy, but it's easy to kind of demonize one side over the other, right? Some people demonize the doctors. Other people demonize the parents. But the reason for that is each side thinks the other side, what they're doing is inhuman, because it causes more suffering for Charlie. And so the parents of Charlie, they think this could improve things for Charlie, whereas the doctors are saying, no, this treatment isn't going to reverse the brain damage. It's only going to prolong his suffering. So why would you do that, right? And so the doctors are saying, this will actually prolong the suffering.
Let me just pause you there, because now I think I'm starting to understand where this argument might be at. Mm. Is in fact the doctors in the UK don't like the experimental treatment because they think the experimental treatment won't bring Charlie's quality of life to a high enough degree to make it worth prolonging his life. Because
they don't think it's going to work the way the parents are hoping it would work. Everybody wants the best for the child. And I thought, as I was reading this, I was like, gosh, it's like I said earlier, it would be easy to start demonizing one side over the other. But everybody involved there, they want what's best for Charlie. The question is, on the one side, you know, the doctors want what's best for Charlie, and what they think is best for Charlie is to end his life and end his suffering. On the other side, the parents, they want to give Charlie another shot. You know, this is the last line of defense, and they have raised money privately to do this thing. So why is it that the state is now intervening and undercutting their decisions as parents for their child? So they can't even decide where and how their child is going.
They're taking away that decision of a parental right.
Correct. I mean, that every parent has ingrained into them that they should and will do everything that they can.
So this becomes a very emotional
to help their child.
Right. You know, story.
I think that's why they raised so much money. I mean, I want to give them money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? Like, no, like they should fight for Charlie's life. But that's the part that bothers me about the whole case with regards to the government and the UK doctors. I mean, it makes me think of, you know, those cases that you'll see pop up periodically of a Jehovah's Witness, right, that is not allowing their child medical care or blood transfusion or whatever it is, and the child's dying. And then the state's got to step in and say, no, we, you know, they need this care, right? Because, why? Well, we want to help their life, right? We want to see them live. And that's the part that's really disturbing to me about the Charlie case is you have a state legislating death, not life.
Right. And the part that's interesting to me too is there is some question over whether Charlie is actually in physical pain. Right. So the doctors are saying, well, it's probable that he is suffering physical pain but is unable to communicate that. Whereas the family's lawyers and their team says it's not likely that he's suffering.
Am I the only one that sees the irony behind a secular system that says it's in the womb, it doesn't feel any pain, feel free to suck its parts out. It is now outside of the womb, you know, on life support. It does feel pain. How dare you prolong its suffering?
I see what you're getting at, because you're saying, well, we don't know. For example, you know, it's disputed, I should say, whether the child in the womb can feel pain or not.
Right, that's what they'll want to say.
Right, and so they're saying,
and now all of a sudden it does feel pain,
we're not even sure. Right?
Yeah, or we're not even sure. But my thing is, don't you think though, Steve, Terry, that the idea of the pain though, is that a secondary issue? I mean, everyone's in pain in some degree. And I mean, goodness, my son got bit by a dog recently, you know, and he's in pain. But does that mean that you don't help the child? Or, I mean, I could think of all sorts of cases in which a child's in pain, but you're still implementing the therapy, right?
Well, they feel like that the pain will just increase with, you know, he's in pain now. They move him to the States. There's going to be pain involved there. And with this new theoretical,
experimental treatment,
there could possibly be even more pain. So the pain just kind of increases is what they're saying.
I see that too. The problem is I think once a legal system goes down this road, like to me, that just opens up all sorts of other litigation to end people's lives over this idea of pain.
Especially in the sort of the Anglo-American world where our legal system is based on case law.
Yeah, I know. Right? You and I were talking about this. This is the thing I find really disturbing about case law and issues like this. Go ahead, explain that.
Yeah, basically what it means is that once a case is decided on, that sets the precedent for the following similar cases.
So. And especially one like Charlie's that has gone to the level that it has.
Yeah, and I believe there is another case before this that's similar. where the state in the UK has stepped in and ended somebody's life. And so this is not entirely new, but it is getting a lot of attention.
Because when it goes to the highest court,
right,
you know, and you've got this case law, well, I mean, then all of a sudden that becomes now the standard. Mm-hmm. And it's only going to open up from there.
It's interesting that it went through three different court cases, appeals, or whatever.
Right.
But even the European Human Society or Human Rights Society court didn't even want to touch it after.
Yeah, they reviewed it and they refused to intervene.
Refused to intervene as well.
Which is, in effect, they're deciding on the case.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just such a messy case. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is just from, you know, beginning to right now, very messy and very troubling for a lot of us. And as we try to work through these ethical dilemmas, right?
Especially because this is a moral issue that everybody feels passionate about, because it is about a 10-month, 11-month-old baby who likes to see a 10-month-old baby suffer.
But I mean, and to me though, the part that I find the most disturbing though is to have a state stepping in and intervene on a parent's basic rights to their child and fighting for their child's life. Let's go back to this pain idea, because I think that this is totally bogus. We all know that doctors can manage pain. I have many friends that are doctors, and I've talked to them in depth about this. Ewan Gallagher, we even had out here.
Intensivist doctor from Toronto.
Yeah, out at the conference last year, and he and I talked in length about this. Doctors are able to manage pain. Like, pain is not a question here. I think that quality of life is really the issue at hand,
right,
particularly with Charlie.
I mean, with Charlie, they don't know for sure because he can't speak. He's not awake. So they could administer something to him that might relieve him of some pain, but they don't know for sure.
I can appreciate that.
That first person experience, you just don't have it. You don't know what it's like to be Charlie, which is why doctors always ask the patient, right, on a scale 1 to 10, how much pain are you feeling? Because the doctor can't experience what the patient is experiencing.
But there's a great example of this, by the way, in the movie Big Hero 6, where there's this robot, you know, that's there to help Hero. But when Hero gets hurt, he has to ask him, you know, here's a scale, tell me, you know, right? Because although this robot's able to scan Hero for any broken bones or anything like that, you can't scan him for pain.
Yeah, what that first-person perspective, right? Another interesting thing that kind of goes along with that is what exactly Ewan Gallagher pointed out during the conference. When it comes to a secular worldview, right, how do you determine what happens after somebody's death? Because the idea is, well, Charlie is suffering. Ending his life will stop his suffering.
But you don't know that.
From a secular perspective, you don't know that. And so where did we get this idea that if somebody dies, that suffering will cease?
Well, and what you begin to see is how quickly worldviews begin to interact with the decisions that are being made. And the assumption in the worldview is that there is clearly nothing after this life, or if there is something after this life, it's better than what's currently in this life.
But even there, if you think about it, from a secular worldview, how do you determine if there is nothing beyond this
life?
That's
the problem.
Mm-hmm. It has to remain neutral on this issue. But what does it mean to remain neutral on this issue when it comes to, say, the Charlie Gard case? What's going to happen if and when Charlie dies?
See, and here's my thing, though, is I don't get the sense that these parents don't understand that their child may very well get taken off life support and naturally die. That very well could take place. But because this is also the part that it gets back to what you're talking about, Terry, with regards to hope, right? They want to exhaust every opportunity to help Charlie. Mm-hmm. And as a parent, they should be doing that. And that's the part that I find disturbing with these doctors, that they want to intervene with that and not allow this treatment that may or may not work. If it does work, great. And if it doesn't work, then these parents are going to have to deal with.
See, I can appreciate that because I had a friend that had cancer and eventually died. But his wife, they said in the hospital, he has tumors in his brain. You know, he's not going to live for much longer. But she took it upon herself to go to the States for some experimental you know, and in her heart, that's what she wanted to do. That's what she wanted the most for him. Tried to help as much as he could, as she could. Yeah. And it might work, it might not, but she made that effort. Right.
And I think as Christians, I mean, this is something that I think a lot of Christians don't fully appreciate, is that we should fight death. At every stage, we should fight death. Death is not the way that this world was meant to be. Mm-hmm. There is, yes, a time in which, you know, death does occur, and we still have hope as Christians that death is defeated through Christ. But in between that, right? I mean, we are people with hope, though, that continue to fight death and should do so. I mean, we don't just, as Christians, give in to death. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the beauty of it when you read Paul's 1 Corinthians 15, where he talks about the resurrection, right? You have to understand that, because some people will argue, well, he's not really talking about physical resurrection. It is a spiritual resurrection. And then they cite cases where Jesus walks through, you know, locked doors and all that kind of stuff. But what they don't seem to understand is that you got to think of the greater context. Paul was a Jew, you know, Hebrew of the Hebrews, he boasted, right? And so what that means for him, and he's a very well-learned guy. He studied with Gamaliel in Jerusalem, that sort of thing, one of the highest rabbis at the time, most reputed one. And so what that means is when he's thinking about death, he's thinking about Genesis, you know, account of creation and how the world was created without physical death, at least for human beings in mind. Right, that was the intent. But now there is this unwelcome death, both physically and spiritually, of human beings. And so when Paul's talking about the resurrection, if there is no physical resurrection, what kind of victory would this be for God? Mm-hmm. You know, God hasn't overcome anything, yeah, really. So the resurrection, as far as Paul's concerned, it has to be physical.
Absolutely. And that's a part of our hope as Christians.
Right.
Is that death has been defeated in Christ, and that it is a physical victory in the sense that we are both body and soul. And some Christians kind of get this idea that soul's better than body or something like that, or that you don't need your body. But no, God created you with a body and a soul, and he's going to redeem both of those things. Mm-hmm. And so we have that hope. And so at the end of the day, if Charlie dies, if this couple was a Christian, I don't know what they believe. But, you know, we have hope that there's more to this life than here and now. But in the in-between time, right, we fight death, we value human life, and we do everything we can to preserve it. Mm-hmm. And so, again, that's what I find really challenging about this, and I find it concerning as you see a culture that continually progresses in this idea of what we've talked about many times here on the show, a culture of death, where death is more and more embraced when it should be life that is more and more embraced and fought for.
To go with that idea, in this sort of, you know, euthanasia, you know, physician-assisted death, all that kind of stuff, we talk about dying with dignity. I mean, I can appreciate where that idea is coming from, but according to the Judeo-Christian worldview, there is nothing really dignifying about death. And I think death wasn't meant to be.
I think that's what one of the justices said, you know, let Charlie die with dignity, right? That struck me odd in the sense that it's just a little child that has no choice here whatsoever, and the courts are deciding he should die now. Or the doctors are saying, yeah, it's time to pull the plug.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Justice Francis, I think was his name, said, you know, it is with a heavy heart, you know, he commended the parents for you've tried everything.
That's
and I'm
true.
Thinking to myself, no, there is still something else that they want to try. But, you know, you've done everything that you can for the child and, you know.
But the Pope and President Trump both sent their support to Charlie.
Yeah, if they can get Charlie to either the Vatican Hospital or to the U.S., which is not happening currently.
Yeah, and to me, again, this is mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. That you see, where you have people who value life, want to do everything possible to help this child, why on earth would you have doctors that would want to intervene with that? I mean, it is really hard for me to understand.
Yeah. It's because they think this is going to increase suffering for Charlie. And
isn't this interesting how we continue to see just a war of worldviews, you know, battling themselves out in our day and age? I think this is something that the state really hasn't taken into the equation, is what will you do to these parents when you intervene in taking that child's life and not allowing a parent to do everything that they can to help this child, especially with parents that have raised the money. They have hospitals and people that are willing to do the work and want to help this child and do everything possible. And you've got a state that's going to step in and going to stop that.
Yeah.
You're going to destroy these parents.
And, you know, like we're all parents here too. And we look at this decision and we're not.
Oh, it's gut-wrenching to watch it play out.
It is hard because you project your family
to this,
right?
Furious if I were these parents.
Yeah.
Heartbroken and furious.
And that's why, as I was reading, you know, some quotations, like excerpts from the decision where Justice Francis says, you know, like commending the parents and then saying, but we ultimately think this is in Charlie's best interest to let him die with dignity. You know, but it is with a heavy heart that we delivered this decision. And so I thought, okay, there is some
emotion there,
and I appreciate that. But at the same time, from a parent's perspective, I'm like, if you were to deliver that decision to me, I'd be furious, and I would feel just like, how empty are those words to me? Like, you're trying to console me by telling me that we've done a good job as parents. We don't feel that way because there is still something, that one option I think we're left to pursue, but you're not letting us pursue it.
And doesn't this also concern you as well? It's always in these extreme cases that the standard gets set for what's going to proceed from here. See, because I'm of the opinion that it's in the extreme cases that we need to be the most clear on our desire to preserve life and do everything possible. Mm. To help, right? See, once you start to compromise, even on an extreme case like this one is, like we were talking earlier with case law and different things like that, it starts to become the standard. And now you just start walking your way down the steps, if you will, in these moral decisions. And now the next extreme case isn't going to be as extreme as Charlie's case, right? And you just continue to descend into a culture of death.
Yeah, and with euthanasia, the concern is that once it is set in place, the bracket only widens, right?
That's
more
right.
And more people are included. That is one of the concerns. And so that's why I look at this and I think, wow, you know, what a worldview that we have in Judaism and Christianity. Because I look at, okay, what are some worldviews that are life-giving? Well, I look at this case and I go, well, I don't think this is a worldview that is ultimately life-giving. But then I look at the gospel and I go, well, it's all about giving life, all about being restored. That's one of the reasons why I love the gospel.
I want to just give out another shout out. We've done this before. I want to do it again. If there are any Christian young people that are looking to go into the university, I got some friends that are going into law and different things like that. Man, we need you. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about Trinity Case and with them wanting to get their law school going and different things like that. We need Christians out there that have a worldview that celebrates and fights for life, that is out there, that is helping making decisions and is willing to get into these battles and help fight for life. Consider using your life to go to university, get a degree in law or whatever it might be, to help a culture that's losing its way.
Yeah, get out there and make an impact. Well, let's end on that note. That's a great note to end on. Before we close, though, I just want to say thank you to all of our listeners who went on iTunes and gave us some good ratings. We've gotten all 5-star ratings and it's awesome. It does make a difference. If you haven't done that yet, we really encourage you to consider doing that. Go to iTunes, look up Apologetics Canada podcast and give us...
You know, a lot of people ask Steve, like, how can we help Apologetics Canada, you know, or I want to volunteer or whatever it might be. How can I participate? This is a really easy way that you can make a big difference and participate with us.
Right. So, yeah, go to iTunes, look us up, and give us a good rating. Of course, if you can, in clear conscience, give us good rating, which I hope is the case, that would really help us. It does make a difference. Thank you for joining us, listeners. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll see you next week with more stuff to think about.